So Dr. Miriam Grossman is a practicing physician, author, public speaker, media commentator. She's known internationally for her courage in breaking ranks and calling foul on the sexuality education industry. She's been on over 200 radio, news and television shows. She's lectured at the British House of Lords and the United Nations Council on the Status of Women. She speaks to parents, students, educators, policymakers, and health professionals on the importance of childhood innocence and the dangers of the powerful sex education lobby that promotes sexual license instead of sexual health. She graduated with honours from Bryn Mawr College. Did I say that right? I hope I did. Close. And from New York University Medical School. She completed an internship in paediatrics at Beth Israel Hospital in New York City and a residency in psychiatry at North Shore University Hospital, Cornell University Medical College, followed by a fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry at the same institution. Dr. Grossman is board certified in psychiatry and in the subspecialty of child and adolescent psychiatry. Sounds pretty bright, doesn't she? So she knows what she's talking about. Would you give a warm Kiwi welcome to Dr. Miriam Grossman?
Good morning. Thank you, Bob. And thanks to everyone at Family First for making this happen. It takes a lot of planning and energy and effort to make something like this occur, so I thank you for that. Thanks to all of you for coming today. You have such a beautiful, beautiful city and a beautiful country, even in the rain. And everyone is so pleasant and so friendly. If only I could understand what you're saying. When I graduated from medical school, I took an oath. I stood up, I raised my right hand, and I swore to prevent disease whenever I could. At that moment, I thought that the battles that lay ahead of me would be against cancer, heart disease, and emotional disorders. But after more than two decades, and thousands of hours with young people in distress, I've discovered that my most challenging fight is not against dangerous diseases, but against dangerous ideas. I'm referring to ideas that are central to what I'm going to call, thank you, the sex education industry. This industry began in the United States, and like many ill-conceived notions from America, it's been successfully exported to the rest of the world. At the helm of the sex ed industry here are organizations like Family Planning and Rainbow Youth. From my review of the websites and other material that these groups have created for New Zealand youth, I see that the approach I'm so familiar with from the States has been duplicated in your country. As a physician, I have one objective: to keep people out of the offices of doctors and therapists. I'm going to demonstrate today how the sex ed industry makes my job more difficult. I know that that's a strong statement, but the priority of groups like Family Planning is not sexual health. It is sexual freedom. The goal of these government-funded organizations is for students to be open to just about any type of sexual activity. Children are told that sexuality extends from cradle to grave, and that early sexual activity with multiple partners is assumed, high-risk behaviors are normalized, and an attitude of openness and adventure is celebrated. In fact, in that clip that we just heard, we heard the woman say, an attitude of openness is so important to her. These, of course, though, are the very behaviors that fuel the epidemics of genital infections, unwanted pregnancies, abortion, and emotional distress, whether or not a condom is used. Young people who practice the lifestyle endorsed by these groups have more doctor's appointments, not less. And that is so for a simple reason. When sexual freedom is the priority, when young people are given the okay to become sexually active and to explore and to experiment with multiple partners, they do just that. And their sexual health suffers. You don't need a PhD in public health to understand this. All you need is common sense. These problems are not abstractions to me. I'm reporting to you from the front line. Over the past 25 years, I've seen a steady stream of people come through my office who were suffering from the sexual decisions they had made. Their suffering was 100% avoidable. To make matters worse, there wasn't much I could do for them because it was after the fact. I'm not speaking about an occasional patient. I'm not even speaking about a few dozen patients. But in my work at a large university in the United States called the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA, I lost count of the number of patients I saw, most of them young women, who had been diagnosed with a sexually transmitted infection or were terrified that they may have HIV or simply confused and upset after hooking up with a guy a few times, developing feelings for him, and then realizing that her emotional attachment was the last thing he was after. Often when I explained to one of these students the science that you're about to hear, she'd say, "That makes so much sense. Why didn't I know that? Why didn't anybody tell me that?" These were good questions, and I began to wonder. If I'd read years ago in medical journals about, for example, why girls are more vulnerable to sexually transmitted infections, or about the biochemistry of attachment, how we are wired neurologically to attach emotionally through intimacy, why hadn't this science reached my patients? After all, they knew all about diet and trans fats, heart disease, osteoporosis, breast cancer, a whole range of health issues. So why this ignorance about the biological consequences of intimate behavior? These questions and others led me to write this book. Actually, it was this book. Whoops. That was the first book that I wrote. Called Unprotected. And each chapter described patients of mine and how they were harmed by the sexual ideologies and omission of biological truths in sex education. The students that I wrote about in this book, Unprotected, made a lasting impression on me. They turned me into an activist. And it's really because of them that I'm here today. After Unprotected, which, by the way, and we can talk about this later in the day, I originally wrote this anonymously because I was so terrified of what the repercussions may be to me professionally for saying what I said in this book. So I wrote it anonymously. The first edition that came out didn't have my name on it. But then there was tremendous support and just wonderful things happened after I wrote this book and I put my name on it. Actually, I was exposed, so to speak, on the radio, but I can tell you more about that later. I was brought out of the closet. So after this book, I went deeper into what's taught in sex education, especially the websites and the books that are recommended to adolescents. And as a physician and a parent, I couldn't believe what I saw. And so I wrote my second book, and that was called You're Teaching My Child What? So for the past 7 years, approximately, I've been studying sex education, or what's called sexuality education, but I call it sex education, how it began and what it is now. I was astonished to realize that sex education is not primarily concerned with preventing disease. Rather, it's a social movement. Its goal is to change society. That was the case 50 years ago when it began, and it is still true. And by the way, 50 years or so, the world was a very different place. First of all, we thought that the problem of sexually transmitted infections was over because we had antibiotics like penicillin that were effective against the two big venereal diseases, what STIs were called at that time, gonorrhea and syphilis. So with antibiotics, there was the impression worldwide that sexually transmitted infections are over. We have a cure. And then the other big thing that happened was that in 1960, the birth control pill became available. So from that, the conclusion was that unwanted pregnancies are also a thing of the past. Now you'll remember, those of you that are old enough, that the 60s was a time of social revolutions, and one of those things was the sexual revolution, in which the message was widely believed that now we're in a different era, an era of open sexual freedom, and we had people like Alfred Kinsey coming out with his research. I talk a lot more about this in my books, but essentially just to understand how we got to where we are now, that sex education is actually based on ideology and not health, the feeling in the 60s when these organizations began formulating their sex education is that we're in a new time period and we have to help young people feel as positive and as open as they can. It was not about fighting unwanted pregnancies and unwanted diseases. And so that's where this all came from. So, like all social movements, sex education is not based on how the world is. It's based on how the world should be, a certain vision, a dream of a perfect world. In this world, this perfect world of sex educators, there are no substantial differences between male and female. If such differences exist, they are not inborn, they are not eternal. Rather, they're due to forces in society against which we are obligated to struggle. In this ideal world, no particular lifestyle is healthier than another. Chlamydia, herpes, and HIV, they infect people in a random manner. They are equal opportunity diseases. Do you use that phrase here, equal opportunity? Okay. In this world, an abortion is like a tonsillectomy. This vision appeals to many people because, after all, why should girls pay a higher price for promiscuity than guys? That's sexist. It's not fair. Why should certain sexual encounters be more dangerous than others? That's homophobic. It's not fair. But this is a made-up world. It doesn't exist. In the real world, biology is sexist. Biology, you could say, is homophobic. In the real world, the differences between male and female are vast and permanent. One of these differences is that girls have unique biological sensitivities, and early sexual behavior endangers them more than it does boys. That's not sexist, it's something that is seen under a microscope. Furthermore, regarding sexually transmitted infections, certain activities and lifestyles are 100% risk-free, while others are treacherous. In the real world, an abortion is devastating for some men and some women. It's a wound that they carry with them for their entire lives. These are indisputable facts. There is no debating them. But when these biological facts challenge the educator's vision of a perfect world, they don't exist. If what's seen under the microscope threatens their dream for society, it's omitted from sex education. That's why I contend that due to the ideology that permeates sex education, and due to the omission and distortion of facts, young people, especially young women, are being sacrificed on the altar of political correctness. We all detest political correctness, but in my profession, when information is withheld, if the consequences of abortion are whitewashed, or a particular sexual act is discussed in a casual way, without waving any red flags, lives are endangered. So the goal is to change society, to create a world without sexual taboos and restrictions, a world free of Judeo-Christian morality. Each individual, regardless of age, makes his or her sexual choices. Each person decides how much risk he or she is willing to take, and no judging is allowed. These ideas are at the core of modern sex education, and they are very dangerous ideas. Three groups pay the highest price when biological truths cannot be told, and cradle to grave sexual freedom is celebrated: girls, women, and men who have sex with men. Please keep in mind that educators describe their material as accurate, ideologically neutral, and in the interest of the student's well-being. And I took those quotes from material here from New Zealand. They claim to provide your children with all they need to know in order to make informed choices. They insist they're on the same page as parents, meaning that they encourage students to practice self-restraint. And I have for you a quote from the New Zealand Herald in response to an article about my visit here on Monday, in which I said, I charged family planning with not encouraging in a firm, no-nonsense manner, not encouraging young people to delay sexual behavior. And family planning chief executive Jackie Edmond responded and said, "We support telling people to have loving, caring relationships and young people to delay having sexual onset." This is simply not true. And yet, as Bob said, when she was challenged, or I would have debated not only her, but anyone from family planning or Rainbow Youth or any of those organizations, there was silence, and no one has stepped up to do that. And I'll once again challenge. I will get up in the middle of the night. I'm leaving in the morning to Australia. But if they want to debate me, I'm happy to do so. And I'll do it after I leave. I can do it from New York. So I want that to be known, that I'm available at any time to these people to discuss the problems with what they're putting in front of your children. Now, I know that there's lots of variation from one school to the next in what students are taught, but I think it's important for everyone to know that in the popular websites and pamphlets created for young people that I reviewed, I found that they are not medically accurate, they are not ideologically neutral, and they do not provide students with all they know. I suspect as well that what most teens hear at home is very different from what they learn from these websites and pamphlets. So these trusted authorities promise one thing and do another. Where I come from, that's called a hoax. And I know that's a serious charge to make, but I promise you, it's the result of years of research and careful deliberation. What I'm going to do now is to lay out the evidence that supports my charge. And I must warn you, I'm about to present some disturbing information. I apologize for that in advance, but you must see it because it's being recommended to your children. So I'm going to show you some of the troubling things that students are taught by groups like Family Planning, Rainbow Youth, and the AIDS Foundation, and then I'll explain the science that's omitted from their message. Because what's seen under the microscope and what's been discovered on MRIs and PET scans affirms biology, and it affirms the traditional values, the Judeo-Christian morality against which they crusade. First, the claim made by these groups that they are on the same page as parents. Nearly 70% of New Zealand parents believe that teens should be encouraged to delay sex at least until after high school. And in public forums, in material written for parents and policymakers, the sex ed industry insists that they have the same goal. For example, your Ministry of Education, their guide for principals, boards of trustees, and teachers, states, a key message within our sexuality education program is the need to delay the start of sexual activity. And like I said, in the New Zealand Herald, this is what the head of family planning also said. And that sounds very reassuring. That is the message that we want to give. But look at this family planning pamphlet that was written for teens. It's called Your Choice. And it says in it, only you should control your sex life. Make sure it's your choice if and when you sleep with someone. Make sure you're really ready. So it's putting it into the hands of the adolescent. Only you know when it is right for you. This is from Family Planning's, this next one is from a pamphlet called Q&A, Answers to All Those Interesting Questions About Growing Up. So clearly, it's for young kids. There is no right age to have sex. The age someone chooses to have sex is different for everyone. It needs to be when it feels right for that individual person. And this coming one is from a site called theword.org.nz. See, I'm getting it. Normally I would say Z. You see? So my goal actually was by the end of this week to have your Australian accent when I go home.
New Zealand.
Oh! Oh my gosh. I am so sorry for that.
We are a forgiving people.
I'll tell you what. When I speak in New Zealand, in Australia, I'll say New Zealand. So this coming one is from a site called The Word. And this is a site that Family Planning links to. Before you have sex for the first time, there are definitely a few things that need to be discussed. Are we ready? How comfortable do we both feel about becoming intimate with each other? Contraception. What options works best for both of you? And remember, it's best to use condoms and lube and contraception until you are in a long-term committed relationship. Now, isn't that interesting? I underline that. In other words, the implication is you may not now be in a long-term committed relationship, right? So kids are told, it's up to you. There is no right age. Make sure you talk about contraception. Make sure you feel ready. Now, some teens may ask, how do I know when I feel ready? So here's more guidance from family planning. This is a quote from another teen that they publish, they print in the pamphlet. I think you're ready to have sex if you feel it's right. If you like hear little voices, you know, don't do it, don't do it, you should hold off. But you know, if it's like, yeah, I'm ready, then okay. Now, mind you, according to this advice, you could have a 13-year-old girl who meets a 16, 17-year-old boy, and after a few days, she hears little voices saying, do it, do it. And so long as they use a condom, it's just fine. She's followed family planning's advice. So certainly this is not encouraging kids to delay sexual activity, quite the opposite. Now let's look at the claim by sex educators that parents should be the primary educators of their children. They say in a pamphlet for parents, parents and caregivers are the first and most important sexuality educators of their children. Sexuality education ought to be taught at home. This implies that what they're going to do is essentially build on the parents' message. It implies that they're on the same page. But I'd argue that that's not the case. And I'm going to show you something from a site that family planning refers students to. This is not being on the same page as parents. If there's anything I want you to come away with today, it's that you have to always, always look at the material created for youth. You can't only look at the claims that are being made. This is the claim that's being made to parents. And, you know, policymakers, legislators, the media, you have to always go to the source and look at what they're telling the kids. So, sex ed organizations actually introduce students to high-risk behaviors, discussing them as healthy and acceptable options, but these are activities that most parents don't want their children to even hear about. And this is from the site, this site, curious.com, that is created by Rainbow Youth, and family planning links to them. And I also learned that the government, your government, actually is allowing the programs that family youth create into the schools. So keep that in mind, that they're going into your schools quite successfully. And this is from curious.org, and I will let you read it. Are you able to see that? It's just amazing, actually, that they get away with using this language. So there are many, many other examples from this website and from another site that family planning links to called Get It On. In fact, the material from Get It On was just so objectionable that we couldn't, Bob and I were deciding which slides to make, and we decided to spare you what's on that site. But I promise you, it's even more disturbing than this. So suffice it to say that all this is coming from a worldview, a certain vision of sexuality, in which the focus is not on health, but on being open, accepting, and free of judgment. Of course, what's missing here is the biological truth, like I said before, that certain forms of sexual expression are much higher risk than others. The notion that all lifestyles are equal is a dangerous one. So when sexual freedom reigns, sexual health suffers. Now, there are many examples I could give you about demonstrating how these programs are not medically accurate. But I'll start with the fact that girls are biologically more vulnerable, and they're not being informed of that. So this is regarding, let's start with the human papilloma virus. This is what it looks like. Why does this virus infect girls so easily? In the United States, 25% of teen girls are infected with a sexually transmitted infection. Most of them have human papilloma virus. The other one in there that's very common is herpes. But let's just start with the human papilloma virus, which can cause genital warts and also affects the cervix, and in some cases progresses, goes on to cervical cancer. The reason why young girls, teen girls, are so easily infected is because their cervix is immature. The cervix, as you know, is the opening to the uterus, and what you're seeing here on the left side, circled with that yellow markation, is the central area of the immature cervix, which is called the transformation zone. This is a zone that is very vulnerable to infection because the layer of cells covering it is only one layer thick, and that's what you're looking at on the right side of the diagram. You see that one single layer on the right side of the diagram. This one layer is what corresponds to this area, and it's called the transformation zone. Then, as a girl gets older and more mature, with each year that passes, her cervix also matures. This area becomes smaller and smaller, and it is replaced with many layers of cells. So you could say that, it would be accurate to say, that as a girl gets older, she is growing, her body develops its own protection, its own kind of internal shield against infections. You see, the human papillomavirus, its goal is to get to this bottom layer here. And it's only when it gets to this bottom layer that it can reproduce, which of course is the goal of all microorganisms, is to reproduce. That's all they want to do. And so when it gets into this lower level, and it's very easy to penetrate this one layer, it successfully makes a home, takes up a home here in this lower level, and it begins to rapidly reproduce. And from that, we're getting the abnormal pap smears, and those sometimes progress to pre-cancer and then sometimes to cancer. But when a woman is older, and when she gets into her early 20s, and everyone is different, usually after I give this talk to college students and high school students, they all want to know, when will my cervix look like this instead of like this? And I can't give them a date and time that will happen. I can only say that from my talking to gynecologists who regularly are visualizing the cervix when they do exams, they tell me that each girl is different, but generally when you get into your 20s, the area is significantly smaller. Now, there are two environmental factors that have been found to affect the rate of maturation. So remember, what we want is for the cervix to mature. And those two factors are when girls smoke cigarettes and also when they're on the birth control pill. So when we put young women on the birth control pill to protect them from pregnancy, we may inadvertently be increasing their vulnerability to these sexually transmitted infections. And that's something very important to know. Now, I like to call these cells over here politically incorrect cells, because they are the reason why one reason why girls, females in general, are more vulnerable. And boys do not have these kind of cells in their reproductive system. So from this, just from this in and of itself, this one medical finding, it's fair to say, oh, whoops, sorry. This is a picture of a mature cervix. That's the thick, that nice pink, flat area is many cells thick. And you'll see that it's all uniform, it's all the same. And then an immature cervix looks like this, and that central area that looks orange here is the transformation zone. And let me also just explain that the transformation zone is much bigger. It's, you see, it's made out of these deep crypts, so it's not flat. The surface area is actually huge because it's made out of these deep crypts. Do you understand what I mean by that, right? Like valley, like very deep. So the surface area, you know, if you were to flatten it out, it would be huge. So it's actually, even though it may sometimes look small, but biologically, on a microscopic level, it's actually very, very large because it goes deep, deep inside, and then there's branches that go out. So, you know, this is stuff that you could teach, you know, young kids. A 10, 11-year-old child would understand this. So, biology says wait. And biology also says that girls are more vulnerable than boys. Another very interesting thing, I can't spend a lot of time on all this, but another reason why girls are more vulnerable is because with their monthly cycle, their immunity goes up and down. And when their immunity is lower, they can fight off infections, you know, less well. And it happens to be that it's right at ovulation when the immunity in the reproductive system of a girl and woman is lower. And that is because the body doesn't want to recognize sperm as a foreign object. And so the immunity goes a little bit lower. But anyway, girls have times within their cycle that they are more, that their immunity is weakened. Now, all of this biology is well known. This is from 2009 from the Centers of Disease Control in my country. But this has actually been known, that sexually transmitted diseases pose a severe threat to women's health and fertility. Biological factors place women at greater risk than men. This has been known for decades. And it's unlikely to change, even if your Council for Civil Liberties threatens a lawsuit. But the science about girls' vulnerability is omitted from sex ed. All the while they claim to be feminists, right? They claim to be advancing the welfare of young women, but it's totally upside down. If they really want to advance the welfare of young women and have an eye out for girls, this information about their cervix should be at the front and center for anyone teaching science-based sex education. Real feminism protects women and girls. A few more things about the human papilloma virus, because when I look through the material that's been created for your young people, the emotional consequences are whitewashed. In other words, because the human papilloma virus, as well as, you know, herpes and other things, there is some treatment for them, and often the virus goes away for a long time, sometimes for your whole life. The way it's presented to young people, I feel, is not accurate. And there is here I have a study that was done here in New Zealand. It showed that 75% of patients experienced depression and anger at their initial diagnosis, and for one-third of these, the feelings persisted for years. And this is this can occur even if, for example, you just come, you go to the doctor, and you're told that your smear is not completely negative, that it has, you know, a change in it that will have to be followed every 6 months. And the girl is told that this is due to having the human papillomavirus. Now, that, you know, to what happens is that that is downplayed in the material for kids. But I'm not going to get too graphic here, but, you know, these viruses cause warts and blisters in private places. And to enter a relationship knowing that at any time you could have an outbreak of warts or blisters on your genitals, it's hard to feel beautiful, it's hard to feel attractive when you know that you could pass these viruses along to another person that you care about. We're talking about viruses that can stay with you a very long time. There's no cure. An outbreak can ruin your wedding, can ruin your honeymoon, can complicate your pregnancy. So this is very big stuff. And I would recommend that if there is a particular young person that you're worried about in your life, it's a good idea to go online, take that young person with you, sit down in front of a computer, Google the words HPV support or herpes support, and you will get, you Google that, and you get a number of sites that are created for people to log on anonymously and meet others who have been diagnosed with these viruses and share their stories. And if you just spend, I promise you, 3 minutes on one of these sites with a young person, and they read what it's like to have these infections, I think it will really be a wake-up call for them. Another thing that young people are not told is that oral sex and even deep kissing are associated with the development of oral HPV. So the virus is passed from the genitals to the mouth and the throat. And the reason why that's not good is because then that can go on and cause throat cancer. Oh, sorry. So throat cancer used to be a disease of older people who were heavy smokers and drinkers. But now it's been noticed that there's an increased incidence among relatively young people in their 30s and 40s who were never smokers or heavy drinkers, and the cancer is associated with having more than 5 lifetime oral sex partners. And it's a serious cancer. The 5-year survival rate is 52%. So this is something that, you know, hello, we need to be telling young people that oral sex can really be quite dangerous. In addition, I just learned this last week that HPV has been associated now with an increased risk of heart disease and stroke because researchers believe that the virus inactivates a gene that regulates heart disease. So it's really not what they want young people to believe. Wear a condom and you'll be protected. It's very complicated, and we really only know the tip of the iceberg. And as time goes on, new things are being discovered. This information about throat cancer is really just the past, I would say, 10 years. And this about cardiac disease, that's new. I think that's from this year. That's brand new, or maybe last year. So don't whitewash sexually transmitted infections. Now, in terms of boys and not having that layer of vulnerability in their reproductive system, they do have it in their gastrointestinal system. In other words, in their GI system, and this is one of the many reasons that anal intercourse is so dangerous. This is one of those difficult topics, but you need to know about it. Kids are being told that There are three types of sexual intercourse: vaginal, oral, and anal. And they do not learn that even with a condom, anal intercourse is a high-risk activity, at least 20 to 30 times more risky than vaginal intercourse for the transmission of HIV. And that is because the way it has to do with the physiology of the vagina, with the pH, the type of mucus that exists there, the thickness of the lining, the fact that there's a lot of elastic tissue because it's a birth canal, whereas the rectum, the pH is higher, the lining is one cell thick, like that immature cervix. There's no elastic, and there's a type of cell there called M cells. Very, very interesting. These M cells actually pick out the HIV particle and bring it into the body. And these M cells are not present in the vagina. So what I like to do is to give students the same advice that a friend of mine gives to his kids. My friend John Potterat, for 30 years, he was the director of all the STD and AIDS programs in a city called Colorado Springs. And he has authored about 200 publications about STDs. He's really an expert. Before his kids became sexually active, he told them the anus is an exit, not an entrance. This is not the Bible, he told them. This is science. Nature put a tight sphincter at the entrance of the anus for a reason, to say, keep out. Few of us are STD experts like my friend John, but all kids deserve to hear his insider wisdom. However, they won't be hearing it from the people over at Family Planning or Rainbow Youth or even from your Ministry of Health. The last thing that I want to tell you about in 10 minutes is the biochemistry of attachment. This is very exciting science about sexuality and human attachment. And I'll tell you very briefly about a patient of mine who I call Kayla. And she came to me when I was working at the University Counseling Center. She was having one-night stands, called hooking up. She was 18 years old, and she came to see me because she was unable to get to class for 2 weeks. She was drinking and smoking pot most of the night, and she was sleeping during the day. She had fallen into this pattern after meeting a boy by the name of David. And David was a guy that lived down the hall from her. We, in our dorms now, the dorms are generally mixed on college campuses. Do you have that as well? The boys and girls are together even on the same floor, even sharing the same bathrooms sometimes. So that was the situation she was in. And David was nice and he was very cute. And they hung out together with the same group of friends. Well, one night they started kissing and one thing led to another and they had sex. After this happened a few times, Kayla discovered that she actually had some feelings for him. And she, when she came in to see me, she said, I can't stop thinking about him. What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And she found that the more time she spent with David, the more time she wanted to spend with him. She wanted a relationship. But he told her, no way. She wasn't into that at all. He wasn't into that. Now, what she would do then is hook up with David and act like it didn't matter to her. That's what everyone else seems to be able to do, she thought, so why can't I? But in fact, Kayla was always hoping to hear from David. She was waiting for a text message, for an email. She longed for some sign of connection, some indication that she actually meant something to him. People close to her noticed that she was irritable and moody. And because she was having some trouble concentrating and sleeping, she began to fall behind in her work, and she turned to alcohol and pot to help her relax. David was always around, but he was only interested in hooking up with her, not much else. Things spiraled downward. Kayla was failing three subjects. She was drinking and smoking every night, and when she was high, she'd hook up with other people. I told Kayla that I could get help for her to stop smoking and drinking, and she was fine with that. But then I advised her to stop hooking up. I told her no kissing, no sex, nothing. At least not for now, because she was too fragile emotionally. Well, that she couldn't believe. No kissing? She said to me, I can't kiss any guys. Kissing is an intimate behavior, I told her. It has an effect on you. How about trying it for 1 week? Can you agree to that? Okay, she said, but this is going to mean a big change of lifestyle. I'll need something to remind me. Well, there was this rubber band on my desk, a wide rubber band. I said, take this rubber band and on the rubber band write, no hooking up. Put it around your wrist and keep it there until our next appointment. It will remind you of our conversation. Now, I promise you that telling a patient to wear a rubber band with advice on it is not something that I learned in medical school. And nor was it any more than just a stopgap solution to her crisis, but I considered her behavior an emergency, because whether or not she used a condom, she could show up at her next appointment pregnant or infected with herpes. So I did whatever I could to help her stop these chaotic and meaningless encounters. She took the rubber band, she wrote no hooking up on it, and she wore it. Now, what's wrong with this picture? She was a bright girl. In fact, she was an honor student in high school. Kayla and David knew very well what was and was not responsible sexual activity. In fact, they had followed the guidelines that they had learned in sex education, that sex be consensual, non-exploitative, honest, pleasurable, and protected. They had done all those things. Their encounters met those criteria. They followed the rules. So what went wrong? What went wrong is that, like so many young people, especially girls, Kayla was naive and misinformed. She was unaware that as a woman, she has vulnerabilities related to sexual behavior that David doesn't. She didn't realize that a single encounter, even with protection, can have profound consequences. When Kayla is with David, her brain is flooded with a hormone called oxytocin. Oxytocin is a politically incorrect hormone. It challenges the belief that the differences between men and women are due to socialization. A hormone is a molecule that travels from one organ to another with a message. Depending on the context, oxytocin carries different messages. During labor, it travels from the brain to the uterus saying, contract and expel the baby. During nursing, it travels from the brain to the breast saying, make milk available. It also travels from one part of the brain to another with messages about feelings. If you inject a virgin rat with oxytocin and then you put her in a cage with another rat's litter, she will act toward those baby rats as if they are her own. She will mother them. So oxytocin carries a message, create a bond, create an emotional connection. Now, oxytocin is released during intimate behavior too, during intimate touching and kissing and certainly during intercourse, although intercourse is not necessary. And need I say that condoms have no effect on the actions of this hormone. Am I proposing that a casual sexual encounter causes a deep emotional bond such as you see between a mother and child? Because during labor, delivery, and nursing, oxytocin levels are just sky high. And so there's this emotional attachment that's created between mother and child. I am not comparing casual sex to that. That would be ludicrous. But what I'm suggesting is that a girl must learn from her biology and understand that she's wired not only to experience pleasure from closeness and intimacy, she's also wired to have this emotional reaction. I want to make sure, though, not to mislead you. Men also have hormones. They also have some oxytocin, not as much, and other hormones that promote attachment. And obviously, they develop emotional bonds. But remember that men, especially young men, have a lot of testosterone. Testosterone drives them to want to distribute their DNA as far and wide as possible. Another difference between male and female is that estrogen ramps up the effects of oxytocin and testosterone dampens it. And now I only have 2 minutes, so I'm going to do this very fast. But oxytocin, we now know from the past 10 years or so that oxytocin affects our judgment because it affects the part of the brain called the amygdala, whose job it is to assess a situation. Oh, I just got more time. Thank you. So oxytocin is released in the brain during intimate behavior, and it affects the part of the brain that looks at the situation that you're in at the moment and decides, is this risky? Is this okay? Should I be alert? Should I be alarmed? Or can I relax? And oxytocin dampens the activity in the amygdala, which means it's not really working to its full efficiency. It's being told you can relax. It's being told, don't worry, everything's okay. So basically, when Kayla is fooling around with David, the oxytocin that's released at that time is affecting how she is feeling and how she is even thinking. And this is very, very interesting that oxytocin is being used experimentally in high-functioning autistic individuals. As you know, autism is a neurological disorder in which people are impaired in their ability to connect with other people. People with autism feel more comfortable, are anxious around people, and feel more comfortable often with objects. They have trouble reading social cues. They don't make so much eye contact as people without autism. And what's been found is that when oxytocin is given, you can sniff it. It's been produced as a spray, and you can actually buy it online, but I'll get into that later on. So when oxytocin is given to these people with Asperger's disorder, which is a form of high-functioning autism, they are more comfortable around people. They read social cues better. They make more eye contact. And so, this is a very interesting aspect of oxytocin and how it helps to establish connection between people and emotional bonds. I will also say, anyone who's interested in this, we could talk more about it later. This has to do with a study comparing women who have natural deliveries versus cesarean sections. In a natural delivery, as you go through labor, your oxytocin levels are just sky high. But when you have a planned cesarean section and you don't go through any labor, you don't have those peaks of oxytocin. And two groups of women were studied. The one group went through a natural delivery, and the other group went through a planned cesarean section. And they were put in a room with their infant, and they were placed into a magnetic resonance imaging machine, an MRI, and an MRI was taken of their brain, and it was seen that, so, and then their baby cried. So in other words, the response of their brain to their infant, two-week-old infant, they did it after 2 weeks after the delivery, when the infant would cry, they looked at the brain. And the brains of the women that had gone through the natural delivery with all the oxytocin was more responsive to the crying of the infant. But I don't want anyone to feel bad about having a cesarean section. This is only research that, you know, shows us the actions of oxytocin and confirms that it has an effect, a very prominent effect on the female brain. But I'm sure that women who have had cesarean sections also bond beautifully with their children. So basically, oxytocin switches love and trust on in the brain, and it switches caution and aversion off. And so when Kayla asked me what's wrong with me for feeling attached to David and for yearning for some sign of his feeling toward me, I told her, there is nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you at all. This is how you're wired. This is how we are all wired. And she was relieved to discover she wasn't crazy. So you see, this is another thing that happens when people aren't told about this, about how we're wired to attach. It's like a double whammy because they get attached and then they think there's something wrong with them for feeling attached. The only thing that was wrong with this young woman was her ignorance of her unique wiring, her female wiring. About that, she didn't have a clue. But how could she? The human sexuality experts who promised to provide comprehensive, medically accurate, and up-to-date information failed to deliver the goods. Now, Bob, I want to ask you, because I have this whole thing about condoms, should I do that later? And 4 minutes. Okay, I'm going to talk fast. Okay. So these are coming slides from pamphlets that are produced by Family Planning, and they say condoms are great at helping to protect you from STIs. They say, used correctly, they are up to 98% effective. If used correctly, they are 90 to 98% effective, et cetera, et cetera. This is simply giving young people a false sense of security. In terms of pregnancy prevention, the number 98% can be achieved, but that's only regarding pregnancy prevention, not sexually transmitted infections, and it's only in perfect use by adults. Now, typical use by adults, which means sometimes using a condom and sometimes not, it falls to 85%. So certainly with kids who are, well, I don't have to tell you about kids. The numbers are going to be lower than that. Now, the question was asked at a 2001 conference, what is the scientific evidence on the effectiveness of latex male condom use to prevent STDs transmission during vaginal intercourse? This was a question that was asked in 2001. The United States government brought together a panel of experts for a week to discuss this question and to decide on the answer. And this is the answer they came up with. And this is, I'm not making this up, I'm not exaggerating. It really depends. It depends what you're talking about. Are you talking about pregnancy? Are you talking about HIV? Are you talking about herpes? They're all transmitted in a different way. Herpes and human papillomavirus are transmitted skin to skin. The virus can exist on the skin that's not covered by condoms, in which case you have no protection whatsoever. The virus can exist on skin that looks completely normal. You cannot even see it. And most people who are carrying this virus don't know it. So, yes, it depends. In this study, for example, there was a 30% lower risk. That's herpes virus acquisition compared to when condoms were not used at all, but 30% lower risk. Now, in my country, that was called moderate protection, and I beg to differ. I think that moderate protection, to me, that would mean like 80%, and then very good would be over 95%. We're talking about serious conditions here. It's something that can last your whole life. So look at the, you see, we have to look at these words and ask, what do they really mean? They're not putting the numbers out there because they're afraid that people will stop using them altogether. That's what the thinking is. So on the website of the Food and Drug Administration, which in the U.S. is the part of the government that is responsible for approving medical devices, and condoms are considered medical devices, it says on their webpage, and this is now, I'm switching over to condoms and anal intercourse, because the study in 2001 that I just showed you, that was about vaginal intercourse. And the vast majority, there's very few studies that look at the effectiveness of condoms in anal intercourse. So all these numbers that you see, 30%, 60%, etc., that's vaginal intercourse. Now, during anal intercourse, condoms are more likely to break. And it says here, if the condom, even if it doesn't break, anal intercourse is very risky. And it says on this website, right now, to this day, that anal intercourse is simply too dangerous to practice. And that is the advice that I give to my students and my patients. And I'll tell you something. Even, it doesn't matter who they are. They could be straight, they could be gay. What they say to me when I tell them that? Thank you. Okay, now your condom wrappers also warn that any use for non-vaginal intercourse may lower its efficacy, the efficacy of condoms, and but the kids are not getting that in their sex education. Okay, one last thing. I just want to comment on the research that's been done. Oh gosh, I'm going so over time. This is about the brain of teens, because sex educators, they argue, like that woman did that I was on television with, the close-up, she said, what we do is you have to give them information. Just give young people information, condoms, contraceptives, and then leave it up to them. They can make their own smart decisions. Well, I'm afraid not. We all know, anyone who's had a teenager in their house or in their office or in their classroom knows, that teens do very goofy things. And when you ask them later on, what were you thinking? They say, I wasn't thinking, I guess. And now we know, this is also new science, we know that the part of the brain that is responsible for thinking things out, like the CEO of the brain, okay? It considers the pros, the cons, the consequences. It says, is this a smart thing I'm doing today? Will I be happy with what I did tomorrow? That part of the brain is the last part to mature. It doesn't mature until you're in your 20s. And so this, in the U.S., we have this company called Allstate, and it sells car insurance. And they're trying to let people know, why is car insurance so expensive for teenagers and even young adults? And so they draw on this research, and they say, why do 16-year-olds drive like they're missing a part of their brain? Because they are. Now, this goes to the heart of the approach of sex educators, of saying, just give them information, tell them how to put a condom on, and then, you know what, when they're all excited and they're with this cute girl and it's the first time, or, you know, and they're getting into it, you know what they'll do? They'll stop. They're going to stop in the middle of what they're in the middle of. They're going to stop and think, ah, I remember what I learned. Let me see. Do I have a condom? Has it expired? Let me look at the date. Yeah, that's really going to happen. And then they say we're not realistic. Okay. I am going to say now that, let's see, I'm just going to wrap up and tell you that in a recent interview, I was told that I must be exaggerating when I say sex education is madness and that it teaches untruths to our kids. I was asked, wouldn't there be congressional hearings in Washington about that? But I am not exaggerating. From my perspective, having taken that oath to prevent disease, the principles of our Planned Parenthood and your family planning are madness because they promote sexual freedom. When sexual freedom reigns, sexual health suffers. Is every young person going to delay sex? Of course they're not. But we are still obligated to inform them of the risks they face and to teach them the biological truths about their physical and emotional vulnerability in a no-nonsense manner, to encourage the highest standard. That's what we do in every other area of healthcare. When it comes to sexuality, though, kids are being taught that they can play with fire. And the waiting rooms of doctors and therapists are filled with people who have been burned inside and out. So I urge all of you in this room to condemn these messages and to tell kids that what they're seeing on TV is fiction and that science affirms the age-old wisdom of restricting sexual expression to adulthood and optimally to marriage. It's not easy to speak of these things. It's awkward and everyone squirms, but the stakes are very high and it's too important not to. Thank you very much.